You are listening to 90.1 FM KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss.
Step by step along this march, can be won, many stones can form an arch, singly done.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions and is sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at UMKC. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. Tonight's show is being underwritten by IBEW Local 124 and United Steelworkers District 11. The International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers supports the Heartland Labor Forum. We have been wiring Kansas City since 1905. If you're not finding your electrical contractor at IBEW124.org, then you're not getting the best value for your money. And United Steelworkers District 11, representing 33,000 members in the Midwest, protecting workers' rights and organizing the unorganized. We support union-made products. We thank our underwriters for their contributions to the Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI. On tonight's show, we'll ask, is vocational education disappearing or coming back? Have we made a false choice between college and skills training? Then, we go to the streets and find out about Street Medicine KC, which provides medical and behavioral care directly to those living and sleeping on the streets. In the news, Kansas City Question 3 on the $15 minimum wage is up for a vote on Tuesday. And the Economic Policy Institute says right-to-work bills don't lead to more manufacturing plants or better jobs or anything good. Our feature at the end of the show is Safety First with Mary Ariel. She'll talk about Trump's OSHA slashes, that ruin many worker safety rulemaking plans. Also, the death toll is up to 5 in Tampa electric accident. And finally, farm workers ready to fight back until pesticide is banned. Now for the news.
This is the news from our side, August 3rd, 2017. The grassroots groups and social justice organizations that make up the KC for 15 campaign will host a final rally on Sunday, just 2 days before the critical special election in Kansas City, at St. Mark Union Church, 1101 Euclid Avenue. A press conference will be at 3 p.m. with the event beginning at 4 p.m. Their mission is to pass Question 3 on the August 8th ballot to win a $15 minimum wage for Kansas City. Partners include the Southern Christian Leadership Conference of Greater Kansas City, Freedom Inc., Indivisible KC, Communities Creating Opportunity, the Urban Summit, National Black United Front, Metropolitan Organization for Racial and Economic Equity, our Revolution KC, and the American Friends Service Committee KC. The Faith for 15 rally aims at people of all faiths to come together to seek justice for the poor, as demanded by the scriptures of multiple religious traditions. Faiths represented at the rally will include American Indian spirituality, Baha'i, Buddhism, Judaism, Christianity, Islam, pagan, Sikh, and Vedanta. The Greater Kansas City Interfaith Council has endorsed the campaign and is helping with the rally. "We have an opportunity to rise up and change the game for the working poor," said Dr. Vernon Percy Howard, Jr., president of SCLCGKC and chair of the KC for 15 Steering Committee. "Let's honor this city, our community, our families, and our Lord." The rally comes at a time when the KC for 15 campaign is starting to receive national attention. The National Our Revolution, a progressive organization inspired by the Bernie Sanders campaign, officially endorsed KC for 15, as has the United Church of Christ.
The Missouri-Kansas City Committee to Protect Pensions issued the following statement today. An enthusiastic crowd of retired Teamsters and friends assembled at UPS package terminals in Kansas City and Lenexa, Kansas. Their presence commemorates the 20-year anniversary of the historic 97 UPS strike. While some are too young to remember the most successful strike in recent labor history, there's little cause to celebrate. Many are aware that the strike of 97 was a fight to protect retirement security. Most are appalled that retirement security for them and all America has been in a downward spiral since the 97 victory. All UPS employees remember the long list of broken promises made by UPS. Since the 97 strike, the company has eliminated a profit-sharing program, reduced management retirement benefits, purchased unfunded liability in the Central States Retirement Plan, lobbied to support the Multi-Employer Pension Reform Act of 2014, which allowed for huge unilateral cuts to pensions, and now has proposed a 20% across-the-board cut to pensions that saves them nearly $11 billion. The committee, made up of mostly retired Teamsters, says the retirement security betrayal forced on UPS employees is the ultimate insult to all of us who have dedicated our careers to the success of this company. It adds, the struggle for retirement security is a very real issue for all, union and non-union, and a corporate climate that is constantly seeking new and creative ways to maximize profits while minimizing employee benefits. Once again, the employees of UPS can lead the fight that will be joined by all of working class America. For indeed, our fight is their fight, and theirs is ours. That's how they won in 97, and that's how they will win now.
And a Kansas City appeals court Tuesday denied a motion by right-to-work proponents to move a case challenging the legality of 10 initiative petitions to the Missouri Supreme Court. The case challenged the legality of 10 initiative petitions by Mike Lewis, president of the Missouri AFL-CIO labor union, long before Governor Eric Greitens in February signed a bill making Missouri the 28th right-to-work state. A Cole County judge initially ruled in March the petitions used valid language but were invalid because the law passed the General Assembly after the petitions were drafted. According to the News Tribune, the plaintiffs could appeal to the Supreme Court, Missouri Supreme Court. Meanwhile, union members and allies are getting close to having more than enough signatures on petitions to be able to block the August 28th implementation date of the right to work law and force it to vote of the people, November 2018. There will be a mass turn-in rally at the Teamster Hall on August 10th from 4 to 7 p.m. They want all petitions turned in and notarized that date.
Meanwhile, the Economic Policy Institute has weighed in on the economic ramifications of right-to-work if it should be implemented. EPI says right-to-work bills don't lead to more manufacturing plants or better jobs or anything good. They lead only to weaker unions, less bargaining power for Missouri workers, and lower wages. According to a 2015 study by Elise Gould and Will Kimball, wages are 3.1% lower in so-called right-to-work states for union and non-union workers alike. After correctly accounting for differences in cost of living, demographics, and labor market characteristics, the negative impact of these laws translates to $1,558 less a year in earnings for a typical full-time worker. Washington University and St. Louis professor Jake Rosenfield, in a study done a year ago, finds that the dramatic decline in union density since 1979 has resulted in far lower wages for non-union workers, an impact larger than the 5% effect of globalization on their wages. Specifically, non-union men lacking a college degree would have earned 8% or $3,016 annually more in 2013 if unions had remained as strong as they were in 1979. Between 1979 and 2013, the share of Missouri private sector workers in a union has fallen from about 34% to 11% among men, and from 16% to 6% among women. The author notes that unions keep wages high for non-union workers for several reasons. Union agreements set wage standards, and a strong union presence prompts managers to keep wages high in order to prevent workers from organizing or their employees from leaving. Moreover, unions set industry-wide norms, influencing the moral economy. That's why the so-called right-to-work efforts make no sense, says EPI. We need workers to have more bargaining power, to negotiate for higher wages. The right-to-work laws are designed by the business lobby to benefit corporate titans. The news tonight was read by Jen Zaman, Michael Savoir, Molly Madden, and myself, Ariana Eckel.
Hello, and again, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Joyce McCauley, and we all know that when school is out for high school seniors, they have decisions to make. Tonight, we will start a discussion on vocational training. Is it disappearing, or is it coming back? We're happy to welcome the director of the Kansas City Public Schools Manual Career and Tech Center, Ms. Rashawn Carruthers, to discuss this question. We would like to talk to our listeners a little bit about the career options that are offered at Manual Tech Center.
Good morning. This is Rashawn Carruthers. I'm the Director of Career and Technical Education for Kansas City Public Schools. At Manual, we offer lots of career options for students in the Kansas City area, specifically Kansas City Public School students, but anyone who lives in the Kansas City area, whether public, private, charter, homeschool, can attend Manual and explore opportunities in engineering, computer science, teacher education, health science, culinary, EMT, auto tech, auto collision, and construction technology.
That's quite a bit of curriculum that's put together. How do kids qualify for these programs?
To qualify for the program, students work with counselors at their home schools. And when I mean their home schools, I mean where they go to school full time, beginning their freshman year, their home high school. Beginning their junior year, they can attend classes at Manual and they come to us for a half day. So they either come in the morning or afternoon session for 2.5 hours, depending on their schedule. And so they work with their counselors to identify what program suits their needs through talking through career interest surveys, and then the counselor looks at their grades and their attendance and looks to see if that student is on track for graduation, and then schedules the student in the program of their choice.
Okay. Do you work with companies or union groups around the area to develop the curriculum?
Absolutely. It's very important for us to work with industry so that we ensure that we are being relevant to today's workforce, to the needs of the workforce of today. Specifically for the EMT program, we partner with the Kansas City Fire Department. The Kansas City Fire Department came to us and said that they wanted to develop programming that allowed them to hire workers that looked like the community in which they were serving. They wanted a more diverse workforce. And so we were able to partner with them, and the fire chief said, if your students meet certain requirements, meaning drug-free, complete the program, complete the National Registry exam, then we will hire them as an apprentice. And so we just had our first group of ENT workers to go through. This was our first year. We're now going to our second. And we have similar programs in the construction area as well as health science. And then we have advisory boards for everyone so that we always have a pulse on what the industry needs. And we always ensure that we have the tools developed for our students to use that are industry recognized as well.
So it sounds like some of the programs are new. Are there any that have been around for some years so you can track the successes of your students?
the EMT program is new. It's going to second year. The educator prep program for students who might want to become teachers will be starting that for the first time this month. The programs that have been around for a while are culinary programs, our auto tech, auto collision, and our construction program, as well as our health science program.
It looked like on the website you had a project, Lead the Way, or PLTW. That sounds real interesting. Could you explain what that one is about?
Project Lead the Way is a recognized STEM program that has, and it's a national program, and it has a lot of support in our area from Missouri S&T, Missouri Science and Technology, and RALA. And the Project Lead the Way curriculum centers around engineering, computer science, as well as biomedical. And so students in the Project Lead the Way classes, they really have good hands-on, rigorous access to high-level curriculum. And at the end of their course, they take what is called an end-of-course exam. And students that score a certain amount, like a 4 or higher, they can get college credit from certain universities, depending on what area they're going to, whether it be engineering, biomedical, or computer science. And the Project Lead the Way curriculum takes them through different steps, and that makes it really applicable, really relevant, hands-on. And their curriculum starts from kindergarten all the way through 12th grade.
Okay. The other question I had was whether you have a placement service for your students when they leave the program.
And this is why it's really important that we work with industry. Working with those advisory boards, we're able to get those commitments from the companies that say, hey, we'll take 3 students when they finish, we'll take 5. And we really want to make sure that we find the right fit, the right student for those particular companies. So we don't have a placement service, but we do utilize our counselor in order to really sit down with the students to figure out what he or she wants to do after high school. And it's not always just because they're in a construction program, that doesn't mean they want to do construction, but they're able to gain the soft skills necessary to transfer them to any job that they choose to do. And so we just really work with them to develop a really good post-secondary plan so that they are able to either matriculate to a post-secondary institution, whether it be a 2-year or 4-year, an apprenticeship, the military, or a career of their choice.
Well, I'm really impressed. I was impressed when I looked at the website, but now I'm very, very impressed with what our Kansas City Public Schools are doing for our high school students. Is there anything else you want to add?
Well, I appreciate you interviewing me today and getting the opportunity to really speak on behalf of Kansas City Public Schools. And then, like you said, the opportunities we're providing. And we're going in a really, really good direction. We have a great new superintendent that has some really inspirational goals for our students. And he wants all of our students to leave as completers. And what that means is he wants every Kansas City Public School student to leave with a skill that they're able to utilize past high school, regardless of what path they choose to take, regardless if they choose to go to college, or choose to go to the military, or choose to go to work, they are able to support their family, you know, even if they're having a difficult time, if they get laid off or whatnot. They have a skill that no one can take from them. And so with that skill, they're able to gain industry recognized credentials and other stackable credentials where they're able to leave here with a head start above others. And so it's just a really great time to be a student and a teacher or a staff member in Kansas City Public Schools. We're definitely moving forward. We have a lot of great things planned. We have a new strategic plan. We have a new vision, new direction. And so I'm just really excited that we'll continue to be able to evolve and stay on top of the trends and be able to really partner with industry in order to create some wonderful opportunities for Kansas City Public School students.
Thank you again for joining us today.
Thank you.
As you heard before, we are discussing vocational training as another path for a career for students just coming out of high school. And I have a guest with me today, Ariana Eccles. And Ariana's path has been very interesting. And I, first of all, thank you for being with us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
Could you tell us a little bit about how she's, Ariana's an electrician apprentice, and I'd like her to tell us a little bit about how she got there.
My name is Ariana Eccles. I'm a 5th-year apprentice wireman, which is our word for electrician, with IBEW Local 124. I went to college for 5 years right out of high school. I was never exposed to any opportunity to do anything else really other than college or not going to college. That was the two choices. So I grew up on a farm, and I was used to working with my hands and building things. I'd welded on the farm before and that kind of thing. So I went to school for 5 years. They changed the federal guidelines on loans. I was actually in pharmacy school and had to drop out because I wasn't allowed to borrow enough money anymore to cover my tuition. No one was grandfathered in. And so I floated around for about a year, looked around at all the opportunities out there, and there weren't very many. I looked at driving a truck. I looked at being a travel agent. I looked at web design. I looked at a lot of different things. And ultimately, a woman that I knew as a family friend nagged me for about 6 months off and on through Facebook Messenger and said, "Have you considered being an electrician?" And I said, no, you know, I don't think that's for me. You know, I'm looking at these other things. And she'd come back a month or two later and say, "Hey, have you considered being an electrician? It pays really well. Or, you know, you can travel all over the United States and work when you're done with your apprenticeship, et cetera, et cetera." And finally, that was the argument that won me over, was that I could travel if I chose. I wanted to see the country. And I wanted to be able to support myself and not have to rely on a roommate or a partner or my family. That's pretty rare for millennials, is being able to move out on your own and be independent.
Yes, it is. And I think that's one of the reasons that we wanted to have this discussion, was to bring out the idea that there are some other options out there for millennials if they only know where to look. Mm-hmm. And that's another thing that you could probably address. Where if someone's out of high school, or maybe they went to a year of college and they're saying, "This isn't really for me, but I don't know where to look or what the next step could be," what would you say to them?
Well, there's actually a cool website called beuunion.com, beyounion.com. And on there you can read about all the different apprenticeships in the area. I'm in the IBEW Local 124's electrical apprenticeship. It's a 5-year program, no tuition costs on me, no fees, no anything, except for $500 or so. It varies. It's between $400 to $550, I think, $100 a year for books. And they find employment for me, and I get paid while I'm going to school for free. But there's not just the electrical program. There's a wide range of different union apprenticeships in the area. Electrician, HVAC, boilermaker, iron worker, operating engineer, laborer, bricklayer, plaster and cement mason, and the list goes on, about 12 more. So depending on what type of thing you like to do, the apprenticeships vary as far as how long they take. And of course, the details of how they've worked out their apprenticeships varies based on what works for them and their trade. But I can speak to my experience as an apprentice electrician.
Are there special qualifications you have to meet to get involved with an apprentice program?
I'm sure that they vary based on what you're going to be doing. But as far as the electrical apprenticeship, I had to have a high school diploma, college algebra. I had to take a basic exam to determine how good my reading comprehension and math skills were. And there was a physical exam that I don't remember what the qualifications were, but they wanted to make sure that you had good dexterity and that you were able to lift a certain weight and carry it around and that kind of thing. Make sure that you're able to climb up and down a ladder, that kind of thing. They want to make sure that you're physically capable of doing the work too.
Yeah, that actually does make a lot of sense. Could you describe a day for an apprentice?
Oh my gosh, it varies so much. That's one of the things that I like about it. Well, right now I'm working building a cooperatively owned condo down in Lenexa. It's a little rough sometimes. It's not exactly air conditioned, which gets old, but it's interesting because I've not gotten to do very much residential work. Most of what we do is industrial and commercial, with very, very little residential. So in the course of the 5 years I've been doing electrical work at this point, I've worked in a men's warehouse remodel, a cement plant, a coal-burning power plant, a large company's data facility, whose name I'm not allowed to mention. The list goes on. I've been in all kinds of different environments. I've worked at Fort Leavenworth's base, all over the place. So it's from day to day, it never gets old as far as what you're going to be learning now, what kind of work you're going to be doing. I love that.
So the variety is...
I love the variety.
Yeah, that's really exciting for someone who doesn't want to go to the office and do the same thing every day, 9 to 5 type of thing.
And a lot of times, to some extent, at least you're your own boss, especially once you become a journeyman. They give you your project, they give you the material, the information, and then you're left to figure out how to make it work. And I love that self-direction.
Yeah, that does sound like it could be attractive to a lot of people. And the other thing, when we were talking earlier, you're in the union right away,
mm-hmm.
so you get those benefits.
Mm-hmm. I don't remember exactly what the qualifications are, but you have to join within a certain period of time once you start the apprenticeship,
mm-hmm.
and at some point during your first year, your health care kicks in. You get Blue Cross Blue Shield health insurance, dental, and vision, and that's huge in and of itself. But you also get two pensions, an annuity, 401k if you choose to participate, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. It also could lead to a business owner. I mean, when you're finished and you have all of this, these credentials and qualifications, you could start your own electronics business could do it on your own.
I've given it some thought, opening my own electrical shop someday. One of the things that I really love about it is when I first started, I was making $12.85, which that was Tulsa's scale, but up here it's even higher, and it's been 5 years too, so it's gone up. But you're paid based on your experience, not based on who you know, what you look like, what color you are, mm-hmm. what your gender is. It doesn't matter. You're paid on your experience. So I love that about it. I've been doing it for 5 years now, and I'm making $30 an hour. And there's not very many people who can say they got into a career 5 years ago and they're already making $30 an hour, certainly not without a college degree, et cetera.
Well,
so
I think
very fortunate.
I think maybe some college graduates
are struggling
to get there. That's a really good wage.
Mm-hmm.
It's just interesting to me when you'd mentioned that you grew up on a farm, that would really connect. Because on a farm, you can't just go to the hardware store and get something. You have to be very creative and figure it out on your own. So
I think that has been an asset for me in the career, having to figure out a way to make it work regardless.
Yeah.
I think it's that thinking outside the box is very valuable.
Mm-hmm. That is so neat. We're just so glad to have you tonight. Is there anything else you want to tell our listeners about? This career path you took was so unusual because you started out in college and then you tried so many other different things, mm-hmm. and then you know, ended up with something that you really enjoy. And
I'm trying to help my little sister benefit from my experience without having to go through all of it herself. She's 19. Her name's Addie. She lives in Oklahoma right now, but I'm encouraging her to come and live up here with me and look at applying to one of the apprenticeships herself. And my hope is that I can basically keep her supported long enough that she can get on her feet for herself and live independently if that's what she wants, or do whatever she wants. That's something that's not really available to a lot of millennials, because they can't survive financially unless they're willing to have several roommates or live with their parents for 10 years or whatever. It's really disheartening. You can't buy a house because of the student loans if you choose to go to college. Unless you're extremely fortunate, and either you have rich parents or you have scholarships. So I would like for her to be able to avoid that herself and start off on adult life with a clean slate and choices. So I'm going to push her to do one of the apprenticeships, and then once she's finished it, as the lady you interviewed previously said, she's got the skills, she's got the certifications, no one can take that away from her. If she wants to keep doing it, she can. Or if she wants to go to college and support herself working with her skill, she can do that too. And I want her to have that independence, that self-direction.
Well, thank you so much for being with us. And another thank you to Ms. Carruthers for joining us. This topic, I think, is not going to go away. I think it's something we're going to be talking about for a while.
The Jackson County Bar Association presents Law 101, free legal classes taught by judges and licensed attorneys. Classes are from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at the Greg Kleiss Community Center, 1600 John Buck O'Neill Way, Kansas City, Missouri. The next class is August 9th on traffic and municipal law. This message, a service of 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio.
KKFI Crossroads Music Fest is here again. Saturday, September 9th in Kansas City's Crossroads Arts District. Over 35 bands on 9 stages. Tickets are on sale now for just $20. The festival is a diverse slice of the music scene in the area. This year's artists include The Fantastics, Enrique Chi of Making Movies, Javier Mendoza, Crystal Rose, Barclay Martin, Duncan Burnett and Riot, Sarah Morgan, Kelly Hunt, Mundo Nuevo, Kyle Reed, Instant Karma, Hot Club KC, and many more. Saturday, September 9th, the Crossroads Music Fest, a benefit for KKFI. Tickets and more info are available at cmfkc.com.
Dear boss, I write this note to you to tell you of my plight. And at the time of writing, I am not a pretty sight. My body is all black and blue, my face a deathly grey. And I write this note to say why Paddy's not at work today. Whilst working on the 14th floor, some bricks I had to clear. To throw them down from such a height was not a good idea. But then my foreman came along the bloody awkward sod, and he said I'd have to cart them down the ladder in me hod. Well, clearing all those bricks by hand, it seemed so very slow, that I hoisted up a barrel and secured the rope below. But in my haste to do the job, I was too dense to see that a barrel full of building bricks was heavier than me. And so when I untied the rope, the barrel fell like lead, and clinging tightly to the rope, I started up instead. I shot up like a rocket when, to my dismay, I found that halfway up I met that bloody barrel coming down. The barrel broke my collarbone as to the ground it sped, and when I reached the top, I banged the pulley with my head.
Well, welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, and today we have a special guest. Aren't all our guests special? And his name is Jay Bennett. And he's going to tell us all about street medicine in Kansas City. This is Hester Dusick, retired CWA 6360. And we are going to have a great conversation. I met this man in Wichita, Kansas, when he was speaking at a conference. And he just was so powerful that I wanted to have him back here and talk to us. So welcome, Jay.
Thank you.
And what is, you know, I didn't know what that was. What is the street medicine thing that you are the executive director of?
Street medicine was founded by Dr. Jim Weathers in 1992, a physician in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that went out and actually started taking services to the streets of the homeless for seeing all of the impact of the individuals coming to the emergency room for their primary care. So it kind of spurned then about what was going on. And a few years ago, a few of us got together and created street medicine. Obviously, for my part, we started with the social determinants and behavioral health, and then brought in the medical team and medical students to actually make it one holistic approach.
For those who are not familiar with social determinants of health, and many are not, mm-hmm. We just learned a few weeks ago about the zip codes making a difference.
Yes.
So what's a social determinant?
Social determinant is something that our society has created that keeps some people from accessing certain services. It could be access to healthcare, it could be access to employment, it can be access to education, just overall access.
That doesn't tell me what a social determinant is.
A social determinant is something that holds you back.
Okay, so is it money?
It could be money, it could be education, transportation.
Okay.
I can go on and on and on about that.
Okay.
A social determinants is coming off of what we know as social injustice.
Okay.
Within our
or
system.
Or challenges, or however
exactly.
You want to call it.
Yes, ma'am.
So primarily we're talking about people who are living on the street,
mm-hmm.
or sometimes in a shelter.
Yep.
And are we talking about families or just men?
Families. About a little over 60% of the people, the 400 some odd people we've seen in the last 2 years, are men, and the others are women. We have a small percentage of children that are actually out there. And then the strange part about it is that when someone does have a child out in the streets, you'll see that they keep it very private due to the fact they don't want that to be taken away from them.
Absolutely.
From government services.
Mm-hmm. What have you found to be, I know we talked once and we said that there were a lot, I was surprised. You know, first it is, what's the first group that's out there? The most of them. Is it the veterans? Is it, I don't know who it is, but somewhere, I think you told me third were construction workers.
Yeah, so when it comes to the individuals that we've had, and thank to Avila and Park and UMKC for doing research with our data, is that 38.6% of the individuals' occupations were in construction, which lead us to say, what is the core problem there? Obviously, it's a seasonal job. Obviously, it's a very physical, demanding job, which causes physical ailments and injuries to yourselves. And then the mental issue of the tough guy situation, I call it. The other three high categories that we focus on are the largest percentage of individuals out there are African Americans. They're about 8-1 disproportionate towards the regular population. The other is veterans. They're about 10-1 disproportionate to the normal population. And then the third one we found was the LGBTQ, which is about 10-11-1 compared to the normal population.
That has to be a tough group to find a place, because there's, even I remember Synergy. Mm-hmm. Synergy, I was in a meeting and they were speaking of how they wanted to get a separate, I don't know, section or something for the LGBTQ because of the, I guess there were some issues, I mean, within the population.
Right.
That made it uncomfortable for some of them.
Right. Most of the organizations that serve the homeless, the community-based and faith-based organizations, I'll call them CBOs and FBOs, have a religious beckoning towards it and have a struggle dealing with LGBTQ as a whole. So more than half the beds that emergency beds that are here in the city don't allow LGBTQ to even go there.
Oh, I didn't know.
Yeah.
Why wouldn't? That's surprising. Okay. So I think you told me you had a percentage of the number. First of all, approximately how many people do we have that need to be serviced or taken care of on the street here in Kansas City?
So when we speak of the metro, and we're talking about north of the river, Wyandotte, and south into Independence, you're looking at roughly at any time during the summertime, about 6,000 people actually sleeping out on the streets. During the wintertime, that number decreases. Mm-hmm. Individuals go more into shelters and find places to stay or travel out of the city.
Or travel out of the cold weather.
Right. Right.
And you were saying 38% of them would be workers, laborers, or
38.6% of the 422 people we've served were in construction.
Okay. Well, we've identified who these people are and kind of how they might end up there. And then, but what do you do to help them? And how do you find them?
Well, what we do is we do outreach. So we actually hit the streets periodically. We also have a mobile clinic that we set up in Kansas City, Missouri at Whole Faith Ministries, another that we set up in Kansas City, Kansas at Frank Williams, and then again at Willa Gill Center. And we just basically meet them where they're at, provide mental health services, any medical prescriptions assistance through the help of us being part of the Kansas City Medicine Cabinet. And when it comes to our other teams, there's 13 organizations out there that actually hit the streets weekly. And a few of them text me, like, for instance, I got out of vacation yesterday and there I was on a plane getting a message from Team Jesus saying, can you help someone? I'm like, sure, I'm about to get off the plane here in a minute and I'll see what I can do. So there's other organizations that do what they do and then you come to us to help out. I wanted to add something here is that our chief medical officer, Dr. Greiner, and our chief medical director, Dr. Kadavi, all understand that most of the stuff you get out in the streets is only 10% medical, right? 68% of everyone we deal with has been diagnosed with at least 4 mental health conditions. So those are the things that we need to tackle, as well as the social determinants, like I mentioned earlier, social equity. How do we get them back into the system?
So since the population is aging, the population you deal with, so I had read that, for the young people, it was like, get them into drug rehab, get them into whatever it is. What is it that you're dealing with now?
Everything. So I have an 82-year-old vet, reservist vet in Kansas City, Kansas. And for him, it's basically managing his funds. He's taken advantage of every month and people take his money from him. With another one, it's a young lady that has been pregnant a couple times and given her baby up to live on the streets with an addiction. She's not going to come in for addiction. All we can do is meet them where they're at. And when they're ready, I repeat, when they're ready, you have to be ready with them, because they feel like they've been you know, kicked out and disenfranchised from the system and services are out there.
Boy, that takes a lot of patience.
Yes.
I'm just thinking, oh, no, that would, because that takes years.
Mm-hmm. Some of it does. Some of it happens very quickly, and those are our rewards. And the other ones are our challenges that we look at every day. How do we do it? I just recently had a young a man that was a Navy vet, got him into detox, got him into housing immediately, got employment, got a car, everything. And then 3 weeks ago, fell off the wagon.
Off the wagon, oh no.
So obviously what I'm going to do to him tomorrow, my buddy, is go back with him and say, hey man, are we ready? He's going to say yeah, and we're going to do it all over again.
Wow.
Yeah.
That is patience. Yeah. I don't know how much patience I have. But what kind of services are you able to provide with the bus?
Bus. So with a bus?
Well, I don't know. Maybe I misunderstood. I thought you had a bus. Well, you do have a bus that goes around, don't you?
No, we just got a donation from Excellential Services. And then on top of that, our fundraiser, September 30th, is to raise money for a real big RV bus.
Okay.
To provide two visiting rooms for mental and physical health. But as of right now, we hit the streets in our own cars.
Okay.
And we just get it done.
I was hoping for a bus for you. I guess we can.
You know, that's an affirmation. You keep saying that, and we'll get it.
You know, yeah. It. The so when you get out there, I mean, do you get out there and take them in? Do you get out there and deal with them on the street? And also, why don't we tell people why it is they don't come in?
Mm-hmm.
We've got Truman. We've got some clinics. There's Casey Cares. There's all kinds of stuff.
Swope and the rest.
Mm-hmm.
Most institutions do what they can within their policy procedure. And I understand that coming from a Fortune 50 company in the insurance side, dealing with healthcare, primarily in the Medicaid sector. So for me, and my thought of getting them is that they've already been traumatized. And then to go through a system and realizing that something broke, something they couldn't do, they couldn't connect, they end up more disenfranchised and leaving. For instance, have you ever had to call your insurance company about a bill they sent you, right? And imagine that trouble. So you can imagine that compounded with being underserved, underinsured, and homeless. And those challenges just hit you up more and more and more to where they can't really, they just quit. I have individuals that have been out there 19, 20 years now. Some of them are happy and say, I'm not coming in. I'm happy. I'm cool out here. And some of their encampments, homeless encampments, are absolutely beautiful.
How about the one over near Paseo? There's a tent city that's down in there. Guy was up there at the grocery store at Aldi, and he said, somebody stole my tent two nights ago.
Yep.
And then he goes, but I got it back.
Yep.
I got it back. And so I'm going. And it was very interesting to see the relationship of the Aldi workers with the diverse population that they work with.
Yep.
So they don't go in because it's a mess.
Right.
To try to deal with it. And they may or may not have telephone service. I remember City Union Mission probably, I don't know, maybe even 20 years ago or so, they put in little mailboxes for people so that they could get food stamps, because you couldn't get food stamps or SNAP card unless you had an address. Is there anything else that has changed and improved for those who have chosen or maybe not so chosen to be on the street?
Right. I think there's a lot more advocacy out there, a lot more awareness. Like, for instance, at Hope Faith Ministries, about 2,000 people get their mail there. So that really helps with phones and et cetera. Some other data and some pointers throw out there, I'm a little of a data geek, is that 60% of all the individuals have a cell phone with Wi-Fi for at least 7 months out of the year. Right? If they don't have it, then they usually go to a library to connect or some other Starbucks to connect to free Wi-Fi, and then they'll have services that way. So those things are getting better. Years ago, you remember that when you got your phone about 4 years ago, it was like how many minutes, how many texts, how many Wi-Fi you wanted, right? Now everything's unlimited. Mm-hmm. So now it's just 4 years ago. So the technology is moving forward to actually help what's going on here in the streets.
And I think that I think it was Congressman Cleaver arranged something to where all the housing projects would have free Wi-Fi.
Yes, they're still working on that with the Connection Divide, and that's a great organization. One of the key things, too, about the homeless population, not just in the metro, but, You know, we've marked 72 different homeless encampments in the metro. 72. The challenge we have in Missouri is that's kind of easy. The challenge we have in Wyandotte is that most individuals live in houses. So it's a little harder to do the outreach at the streets because they're in
Abandoned houses?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. Yeah. I can see that. Mm-hmm. There are enough of them, but there are plenty of them over here, too.
Yes, it's a unique thing, this Kansas-Missouri thing, where as soon as a line happens, it's different. And I tried just to erase that line, and I'm not from here, but people just, you keep going, but it's not going to happen.
Well, and the same thing, too, that line between Kansas City and St. Louis. They don't even exist.
I understand.
So, well, and which state is easier for you to work in?
You know, we have partners all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Wyandotte, Inc., and Paces, there, they've been a great partner as of late. Whole Faith Ministries, Team Jesus, I can go on and on. Kansas City Eye Clinic, the World Outreach Foundation. All these organizations have been supportive, and we know the only way to attack this thing is together.
What about the government? I have met the mayor over there. Seems like a great guy. So does he work well with you?
Mayor Holland?
Mm-hmm.
We haven't spoken because I keep working. I don't go. I'm the guy who usually keeps my nose to the grind and get things done. But his wife has been very supportive of us on Facebook.
That's wonderful.
Yeah. So Julie's been very supportive on Facebook. And I think I'll reach out to her sometime in the next week or so. And
I think
see
he's a minister too, isn't he?
He is. Mm-hmm. He is.
So I don't know when we've been over there before because mm-hmm. with our own group and found him to be, very welcoming.
He is.
And this is not the first city to have this kind of a medical program, is it?
No, it is not. So what I did is that I went out and found out some of the best practices out there. So in Georgetown, they've been doing it for 30 years. And I spent a day there with them, with Gunter, and who's been there for 30 years, who's about to retire this year. And then we plan on taking the entire team to Chicago for Night Ministry out there mm-hmm. that's been out there for 30 years. And hopefully my team of 12 of us, our medical team, our nurses, our mental health therapists, our psychiatrists, all of us can actually go there and get another scope of what it looks like for some organization that's been doing it for 30 years.
Well, and they would have already worked through the kinks.
Oh, yes.
I think you mentioned that you're going to have a fundraising or something in September, aren't you?
Yes. So we're actually going to be starting raising some money. We've been doing this for a couple of years. I do this and my team does without any pay or salary. We just recently started writing some grants. And September 30th, we have our fundraiser in the West Bottoms. We have artists out there, street theme, street medicine, break dancing. We have Alex and the team and Leo Prieto and the rest of them have been very helpful in helping me create all this and making it happen. So it's going to be a jam and a party. Yeah.
Okay, and that's around September?
No, it is September 30th.
30th.
Stockyards.
Okay.
West Bottoms.
One of my favorite places. Okay, great. Well, labor is listening, and many people who are not labor, and I know some of them, this is brand new medicine, brand new information for them about this medicine. Can you think of any ways that they could help you if they chose to, besides just money?
I can tell you this, is that what we've tried to do and what we continue to do is, I'm a former shop steward for Teamsters 995 out of Las Vegas.
Oh, great.
And I can tell you that the Teamsters and other unions can actually get together and start interns like they already do now with other individuals bringing them in. But I think now it's maybe we can go a little further and how do we get one or two into the system to actually change things?
I think that all you have to do is get a hold of AFL-CIO. We have a good friend down there.
So I guess you're going to help me with that, right?
You betcha.
Amen.
You betcha. So, well, I just so appreciate you coming on tonight and all this information. Anybody that wants to review this can do it because it'll be archived for a year. I am just so grateful that you were there in Wichita because, boy, what a difference you made.
Mm.
And I know that you're making a difference in this city.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much today for being here.
Yep, thank you. Bye.
Working at this job is dirty and dangerous, and I'm taking risks anyway. Oh, if I had the time and the proper equipment, I could do my job safely each day. Everybody here says they're sticklers for safety, and I'm not here to say that they lie. I'm saying we just come to work
is Mary Ario for Safety First. First, Trump's OSHA slashes many worker safety rulemaking plans. From www.bna.com for July 20th, the Trump administration has slashed several worker safety rulemakings following through on the president's vows to reduce regulations. The Occupational Safety and Health Administration now is abandoning efforts to regulate worker exposure to combustible dust, construction noise, and vehicles backing up in factories and construction sites, as well as another that would update the way the agency adopts permissible exposure limits for chemicals. The spring regulatory agenda, released July 20th, cites resource constraints and other priorities for those abandoned rulemakings and offers no new rulemakings on workplace protection. Business interests were quick to applaud the document. Other OSHA rulemakings, including those governing emergency response and preparedness and infectious disease in healthcare, have been moved to long-term actions list, signaling that the Trump administration has no intention to move them forward. The infectious diseases standards being pushed to the back burner puts both healthcare workers and the public at risk. Bonnie Castillo, Health and Safety Director for National Nurses United, told Bloomberg BNA. Castillo said the union will continue to lobby and work at local, state, and federal levels on the issue. Peg Seminario, Safety and Health Director at AFL-CIO, told Bloomberg BNA, there's no surprises here. But Seminario also excoriated the agenda as what she called the administration's failure to stand up for working people. Next month, Safety First will look at changes to Mine Safety and Health Administration's agenda. Next, another death in Tampa electric accident, death toll 5, from the Tampa Bay Times at www.tampabay.com for June 29th and www.850wftl.com for July 21st. The death toll from last month's industrial accident at Tampa's electric Big Bend power plant is now at 5. Initially, 2 were killed and 4 seriously injured Thursday, June 29th, in what is being described as a major incident at the TECO Big Bend power plant near Tampa Bay, Florida. Officials said the accident was caused by a spillage of slag, which is what is left over from producing power from coal. Molten slag, a substance that can reach temperatures of 1,000 degrees, gushed from a containment tank, authorities said, burning those in the vicinity. TECO workers were conducting routine maintenance on the slag tank at the time. The company is working with investigators to determine the cause. The Tampa Bay Times reporters poured through news stories and analyzed tens of thousands of OSHA inspections to identify 19 fatalities at Florida power plants since 1997. Tampa Electric makes up for nearly half, although it covers less than 10% of households in the state. Finally, farm workers ready to fight back until chlorpyrifos is banned, from UFW.org for July 25th. United Farm Workers Vice President Jeev Kashkuli issued the following statement on July 25th on the proposed Senate Bill 1624, the Protect Children, Farmers, and Farm Workers from Nerve Agent Pesticides Act, that would ban chlorpyrifos, a widely used agricultural pesticide. The United Farm Workers commends the efforts of Senators Udall, Gillibrand, Booker, Blumenthal, Harris, and Markey to protect farm workers and their families from this harmful brain-damaging pesticide, chlorpyrifos. We know chlorpyrifos does neurodevelopmental harm in children and expectant mothers who are exposed to it, produces children with lower birth weight, reduced IQ, loss of working memory, attention disorders, and delayed motor development. Farm workers and their families' health and lives should not be put in jeopardy. The UFW invites all people of goodwill to help. According to TheHill.com for June 6, 7 states controlled by Democratic administrations are formally challenging the Environmental Protection Agency's, or EPA, decision not to further restrict the use of the controversial pesticide. The state's attorneys general filed an administrative challenge. The states could file a lawsuit if their initial challenge is not successful. The states say the Trump administration violated federal law regarding pesticides because scientific studies show chlorpyrifos is harmful to the nervous system and brains of young children. EPA head Scott Pruitt in March rejected the Obama administration's proposal and EPA scientific recommendations to ban the agricultural use of the pesticide. Agricultural interests strongly support Pruitt's decision. What pesticides are in your food? Find out at Pesticide Action Network, www.whatsinmyfood.org. This is Mary Ario for Safety First.
And this is the Heartland Labor Forum calendar, August 3rd, 2016. Now you've pissed off Grandma is the chant for Seniors for Justice, a new organization of retired people, mostly from John Knox Village, They've organized a demonstration focusing on health care, saying, "We're out of our rockers and making our voices heard." Saturday, August 5th, 11 a.m. Chipman Road from Jacobs to Pryor in Lee's Summit. Bring canes, walkers, wheelchairs, and signs. Forum to discuss new net neutrality efforts by Friends of Community Media. Saturday, August 5th, 4 p.m. KKFI Annex, large room down the hall from KKFI at 3901 Main, second floor. Final rally for KC for $15. Sunday, August 6th, 3 p.m. for press conference, 4 p.m. for rally. St. Mark's Union Church, 1101 Euclid Avenue. Mass turn-in for right to work petitions, Thursday, August 10th, 4 to 7 p.m., Teamsters Hall, 4501 Cleaver Boulevard, KCMO. And check us out at the heartlandlaborforum.org, where you can also listen to today's show.
Thanks so much, Molly. All right, next week on the Heartland Labor Forum, it'll be the politics of immigration and invisible hands, voices from the global economy. I have been your engineer, Jen Zaman, and please stay tuned for the Thursday night special.
You have been listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. We are sponsored by the Institute for Labor Studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Our volunteers come from a wide variety of workplaces and unions. We are supported by many Kansas City area unions and the AFL-CIO. To talk back to us, to volunteer, or to let us know about news or events, call us at 816-235-1470 or go to www.heartlandlaborforum.org. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI, UMKC, or any of the unions involved. Tune in every Thursday evening to the Heartland Labor Forum at 6 o'clock or to our Friday morning rebroadcast at 5 o'clock right here on 90.1 FM KKFI.